BTO Beyond the Obvious, der Ökonomie-Podcast mit Dr. Daniel Stelter. Featured bei Handelsblatt.
Hallo und herzlich willkommen zur neuen Ausgabe von BTO Refresh. In dieser Woche bereiten wir den kommenden Sonntag vor. Denn, so zumindest ist jetzt die Planung, am kommenden Sonntag ist Kenneth Rogoff von der Harvard University zu Gast und spricht mit mir über das Ende der Dollar-Dominanz. Heute zur Vorbereitung steigen wir tiefer in das Finanzsystem ein und analysieren, wieso es überhaupt so viele Krisen gibt, warum die Finanzkrise vorhergesehen wurde und keiner auf diejenigen gehört hat, die gewarnt haben, und vor allem, was nun vor uns liegt. Dass spannende Zeiten vor uns liegen, ist unstrittig. Wir wissen, die US-Regierung arbeitet stark daran, die Unabhängigkeit der Federal Reserve zu brechen. Offensichtliches Ziel: die Sicherung der Finanzierung des Staates. Der US-Finanzminister Scott Bessent hat sogar einen Artikel geschrieben, in dem er sich kritisch mit der Politik der US-Notenbank Fed auseinandersetzt. Er beklagt dabei unzureichende theoretische Fundierung, Selbstüberschätzung und eine übermäßige Einmischung in die Märkte. Eine Kritik, die wahrlich nicht so einfach von der Hand zu weisen ist. Ich fand das Ganze hochrelevant und deshalb wiederhole ich heute das Gespräch mit William White, dem ehemaligen Chefvolkswirt der Bank für internationalen Zahlungsausgleich. Er sprach mit mir über die Politik der Zentralbanken in Folge 53. Titel damals: Die Zentralbanken löschen mit Benzin. Höchste Zeit also für einen BTO-Refresh.
Haben Sie schon mal direkt gehandelt, also so richtig direkt, so dass es gar nicht mehr direkter geht? Nein, dann sollten Sie es direkt mal mit der neuen App von Europas direktestem Direktbroker Tradegate Direct ausprobieren. Tradegate Direct wurde von Profis für Profis entwickelt und ist speziell für erfahrene Trader mit hoher Handelsfrequenz gemacht, die Wert auf Kontrolle, Effizienz und Unabhängigkeit legen. Die App ermöglicht Privatanlegern den unmittelbaren Direktzugang zur Tradegate Exchange, Europas liquidester Retailbörse. Zu den App-Features zählen Realtime-Watchlists mit bis zu 150 Titeln, intelligente Ordertypen und Performance-Analysen auf institutionellem Niveau. Mehr als 7000 Aktien, 3000 ETFs und tausende Mini-Futures sind über die App handelbar. Außerdem bleibt der gesamte Handel dauerhaft kostenfrei und das auch bei neuen regulatorischen Vorgaben. Die marktüblichen Spreads allerdings können wie bei anderen auch anfallen. Erleben Sie, wie direkter Börsenhandel im Hier und Jetzt funktioniert mit Tradegate Direct. Mehr Informationen in den Shownotes oder unter tradegate.direct.
The Fed has caused a lot of distributional problems with their policies. I wrote a 7,000-word essay on that. You know, we've seen the biggest hindrance for housing here are mortgage rates. So, you know, if the Fed brings down mortgage rates, then they can end this housing recession. Low-end consumers who have gotten killed under President Biden, I think that there are sections of the economy that could go into recession.
The Federal Reserve musste viele Angriffe der Trump-Administration über sich ergehen lassen. Doch im vergangenen Monat eröffnete sich eine ganz neue Angriffslinie, als der Finanzminister Scott Bessent einen Artikel im Magazin The International Economy veröffentlichte, in dem er hart mit der Notenbank ins Gericht ging.
Die fehlerhaften Wirtschaftsmodelle der Fed basieren auf einer grundlegend falschen und sich selbst verstärkenden Annahme, dass die Inflation primär von den Inflationserwartungen bestimmt wird, die wiederum von der Kommunikation und Glaubwürdigkeit der Fed selbst beeinflusst werden. Anders ausgedrückt, glaubte die Fed, dass es ausreichen würde, ihr Bekenntnis zu niedriger Inflation zu signalisieren, um Preisstabilität zu gewährleisten. Der ehemalige Gouverneur der Bank of England, Mervyn King, hat diesen Ansatz treffend als König-Knut-Theorie der Inflation bezeichnet und damit eine Analogie zu dem mittelalterlichen König gezogen, dem nachgesagt wurde, er könne die Gezeiten beherrschen. Wie Gouverneur King es formulierte, eine zufriedenstellende Inflationstheorie kann nicht lauten, die Inflation wird niedrig bleiben, nur weil wir es sagen.
Vor allem kritisierte Bessent die Verzerrungen, die aus diesen Interventionen folgten.
Neben der fehlgeleiteten Abhängigkeit von fehlerhaften Modellen störten die unkonventionellen geldpolitischen Instrumente der Fed eine wesentliche Feedbackquelle, die Finanzmärkte. Die durch die quantitative Lockerung geschaffene Liquiditätsflut senkte die Kapitalkosten branchen- und sektorübergreifend und unterdrückte so die Fähigkeit des Marktes, frühzeitige Warnsignale zu senden, wenn die Realwirtschaft Anzeichen einer Abschwächung oder steigender Inflation aufweist. Unter normalen Bedingungen hätten die Finanzmärkte als Barometer für potenzielle Risiken für die Wirtschaftsaussichten gedient. Stattdessen verhinderten die durch die Maßnahmen der Fed verursachten Verzerrungen, dass diese Signale rechtzeitig auftraten.
Darüber hinaus kritisierte Bessent auch die Folgen für die Vermögensverteilung.
Die aufeinanderfolgenden Interventionen der Fed während und nach der Finanzkrise schufen eine Art de facto Absicherung für Vermögensbesitzer. Dies führte zu einem schädlichen Kreislauf, in dem Vermögensbesitzer einen immer größeren Anteil des nationalen Vermögens kontrollierten. Innerhalb dieser Gruppe von Vermögensbesitzern bestimmte die Fed faktisch Gewinner und Verlierer, indem sie die Anleihekaufprogramme über Staatsanleihen hinaus auf private Verbindlichkeiten ausweitete, wobei der Immobiliensektor besonders begünstigt wurde. Die Auswirkungen dieser Politik reichten weit über die Vermögensbesitzer hinaus, die direkt von der quantitativen Lockerung profitierten. Im Unternehmenssektor verschafften die Interventionen der Fed großen Unternehmen einen deutlichen Vorteil, oft auf Kosten kleinerer Firmen. Größere Unternehmen mit Zugang zu den Kapitalmärkten konnten die historisch niedrigen Zinssätze nutzen, indem sie ihre Schulden zu festen Zinssätzen langfristig refinanzierten. Kleinere Unternehmen hingegen, die in der Regel auf variabel verzinsliche Bankkredite angewiesen sind, gerieten durch die steigenden Kreditkosten unter Druck, als die Fed 2022 gezwungen war, die Zinssätze anzuheben.
Das Ganze gipfelte dann in dieser Feststellung.
Die Fehltritte und die Arroganz der Fed in ihrer Politikgestaltung haben ihre Glaubwürdigkeit aufs Spiel gesetzt und ihre Unabhängigkeit in ihrer Kernaufgabe der Geldpolitik gefährdet. Die Überschätzung der eigenen Macht oder der Macht der eigenen Institution ist eine zutiefst menschliche Eigenschaft. In manchen Fällen kann sie sogar produktiv sein. Für die Durchführung der Geldpolitik ist sie jedoch höchst problematisch. Die Fed behauptet, unabhängig sein zu müssen. Aber ist sie das wirklich? Oder ist sie den Geistern ihrer Vergangenheit und ihrem eigenen Ego verfallen? Die Geldpolitik trug zur Entstehung der Immobilienblase bei und die späte Reaktion der Fed und anderer auf die Warnzeichen verschärfte den Finanzcrash. Trotz ihrer Mitschuld ging die Fed gestärkt aus der Finanzkrise hervor und verfügte anschließend über mehr Befugnisse als zuvor. Leider haben diese erweiterten Befugnisse und ein Mangel an Demut die Fehltritte der Fed nur noch verstärkt.
Bessent sagte konkret, diese Experimente können in der realen Welt verheerende Folgen haben. Einmal freigesetzt, also einmal umgesetzt, lassen sie sich nicht mehr so leicht wieder eindämmen. In Bessents Argumentation war es eine inakzeptable Ausweitung des Mandats der Fed, massive Ankäufe von Vermögenswerten zur Ankurbelung der Wirtschaft einzusetzen. Die sogenannte quantitative Lockerung oder QE. Stattdessen, meinte Bessent, müsse die Zentralbank zu einem wesentlich einfacheren Instrumentarium zurückkehren. Die quantitative Lockerung war von Anfang an umstritten. Und trotzdem wurde sie lange fortgesetzt. Die ersten Aufkäufe von Wertpapieren erfolgten direkt nach der globalen Finanzkrise und dauerten bis 2022 an. Also faktisch 10 Jahre lang. In Wirklichkeit ist es aber so, dass die Notenbanken nicht erst mit der Finanzkrise interveniert haben. Eigentlich intervenieren die Notenbanken bereits seit 1987.
The wildest day in history.
Sonny, there's only one word to describe what's happening, and that is panic.
Well, the law of gravity hit Wall Street today and financial markets around the world for that matter, as stock prices plunged even more than they did on Black Tuesday of 1929.
Wann immer es eine Krise gab an den Finanzmärkten, haben die Notenbanken interveniert. Und zwar einseitig. Sie haben Liquidität zur Verfügung gestellt und die Zinsen gesenkt. Nachdem die akute Krise vorbei war, haben sie aber die Gelder nicht wieder eingesammelt und die Zinsen auch nicht wieder auf das ursprüngliche Niveau erhöht. Damit haben sie Anreize gesetzt, sich immer höher zu verschulden, immer mehr Risiken einzugehen. Und so gesehen waren die Krisen auch vorhersehbar. Vor allem war vorhersehbar, dass die Krisen immer größer werden. Das Ganze führte dann zur Finanzkrise. Und die Finanzkrise war für die Experten nicht überraschend. Spiegel Online veröffentlichte dazu im Juli 2009 einen Artikel mit dem Titel »Der Mann, der zu viel wusste«. Ich habe diesen Artikel in den Shownotes verlinkt. Dort kann man unter anderem dieses hier lesen.
Endlich wird ihm zugehört, ihm und nicht mehr seinem langjährigen Gegenspieler, dem einst so mächtigen Chef der US-Notenbank Fed, Alan Greenspan. Maestro wurde der ehrfürchtig genannt und gefeiert als der beste Währungshüter aller Zeiten, bis die US-Immobilienblase platzte und der Absturz begann. Keiner in der Notenbankszene wagte es bis zu diesem Zeitpunkt, Greenspans erfolgreiche Politik des billigen Geldes laut zu kritisieren. Keiner außer White. Der sah das Unglück aufziehen. White und sein Expertenteam sahen, wie sich in den USA die Häuserblase entwickelte. Sie kritisierten das immer schwerer zu durchschauende Verbriefungsgeschäft, wiesen eindringlich auf die Gefahr unsicherer Kredite hin, belegten die mangelnde Glaubwürdigkeit der Ratingagenturen. Auslöser für die Zügellosigkeit? Es gab schlicht zu viel billiges Geld auf dem Markt.
Dabei warnte William White schon lange vor dem Zyklus immer größerer Blasen.
1997 löste die Politik des billigen Geldes die Asienkrise aus. Als die Ramschkredite, welche die Banken angehäuft hatten, platzten, mussten der Internationale Währungsfonds und andere Geber die Weltwirtschaft mit über 100 Milliarden Dollar retten. Es sei naiv anzunehmen, dass Märkte sich diszipliniert verhalten, beschrieb White das Marktversagen schon 1998. Greenspan blieb ungerührt. Wenige Wochen später bewies der Markt erneut seine zerstörerische Kraft. Russland stürzte in eine Finanzkrise und riss den New Yorker Hedgefonds LTCM mit sich. Und was tat Greenspan? Er senkte den Leitzins. Im Silicon Valley wuchs die nächste Blase heran, die New Economy. Sie barste im Frühjahr 2000. Was tat Greenspan? Er senkte die Zinsen. Das war der Kardinalfehler, meint White. Das billige Geld verursachte den nächsten Exzess, diesmal im Häusermarkt. White war es langsam leid. Gab es keinen anderen Weg, als die Wirtschaft regelmäßig kollabieren zu lassen?
William White warnte und warnte. Von 2003 an faktisch jedes Jahr. Er hielt Präsentationen, er schrieb kritische Jahresberichte, aber er drang nicht durch. Alan Greenspan, der als Maestro gefeierte Chef der US-Notenbank, wurde von allen bewundert. Und heute? Nun, die Notenbanken haben ja weitergemacht wie vor der Krise. Und keiner weiß, wie es letztlich ausgehen wird. Aber man kann und muss in Szenarien denken. Und genau das hat William White, der ehemalige Chefökonom der Bank für Nationalen Zahlungsausgleich, in diesem Podcast getan. Und zwar in Folge 53 mit dem Titel »Die Zentralbanken löschen mit Benzin« im Dezember 2020. Es war, aus meiner Sicht, eine der spannendsten Folgen von BTO. Und deshalb heute BTO Refresh.
Unsere Welt ist ein Universum aus Impressionen, Wissen und Informationen. Allein auf deinen digitalen Devices, in deinen Cloud-Accounts und auf deinen Sticks und Drives liegt mehr Content, als du im Alltag verwerten kannst. Jetzt stell dir vor, dieses Wissen wäre jederzeit intuitiv und smart für dich nutzbar. Dann mach es einfach mit Acrobat. Adobe Acrobat Studio schreibt die Regeln neu. Mit PDF Spaces verwandelst du deine Sammlungen aus Dateien und Websites in gemeinsam nutzbare Wissenszentren. KI-Assistenten helfen dir dabei. Als Analysten, Assistenten oder Entertainer liefern sie dir präzise Themeninsights, neue Dokumente in deinem Stil und kreativen Input für deine Präsentationen. Mit Adobe Express gehst du den nächsten Schritt. Hier erstellst du schnell, effizient und intuitiv herausragende neue Inhalte, Infografiken, Präsentationen, Flyer und Social Media Posts. Die beeindruckenden Visuals dazu liefert dir Adobe Firefly mit generativer KI per Text-to-Video und Text-to-Image. Selbst das klassische PDF-Management bekommt mit Acrobat Studio ein Upgrade. Nie war es so einfach, Dokumente zu bearbeiten, Dateien zu kombinieren, Verträge elektronisch zu unterzeichnen, PDFs zu redigieren, zu vergleichen und zu schützen. Wissen, Produktivität, Kreativität, alles in einer Suite. Mach es einfach mit Acrobat von Adobe. Mehr Informationen in den Shownotes oder unter adobe.com.
Bevor wir zu meinem Gespräch mit William White kommen, noch kurz dieser Hinweis für jene Hörerinnen und Hörer, die auf die gesamten Inhalte des Handelsblatts zugreifen möchten, um so rund um Wirtschaft, Politik und Finanzen noch mehr auf dem Laufenden zu bleiben. Sie können sich das Handelsblatt gedruckt oder digital für 12 Monate mit 30% Rabatt sichern. Das Angebot finden Sie wie immer in den Shownotes dieser Ausgabe und unter dem Link handelsblatt.com/BTO30. Doch jetzt zum BTO Refresh mit William White.
Schon im Jahr 2003 hat William White dem damaligen Fed-Chef Alan Greenspan persönlich dargelegt, welche Folgen dessen Geldpolitik haben wird. Dennoch ist der Kurs fortgesetzt worden, bis sich die Warnungen bestätigten, als 2007 die Weltfinanzkrise ihren Lauf nahm. William White hat seine Laufbahn Ende der 60er Jahre als Ökonom bei der Bank of England begonnen. Danach ist er über 20 Jahre für die kanadische Zentralbank tätig gewesen. 1994 ist White zur Bank für internationalen Zahlungsausgleich gewechselt. Seine Expertise schöpft er aus über 50 Jahren Erfahrung.
Zunächst, wie immer bei englischsprachigen Interviews, die wichtigsten Passagen mit einer deutschsprachigen Übersetzung und danach das gesamte Interview im Original.
Wie kam er darauf, dass eine Finanzkrise droht? Weil das ja sicherlich auch für die Zukunft eine wichtige Erkenntnis ist. Und seine Antwort ist nachvollziehbar. Er sagt, zunächst gibt es einen rationalen Grund für eine positive Entwicklung. Also eine neue Erfindung, technologische Fortschritte, neue Geschäftsmodelle. Es gibt also einen Grund für steigende Vermögenspreise. Und dann kommt aber Spekulation hinzu, dann kommt Euphorie hinzu und vor allem kommt dann hinzu eine immer größere Verschuldung der Marktteilnehmer. Leute kaufen also auf Kredit. Und damit legen sie die Grundlage für den Crash, einfach deshalb, weil sie übertreiben. Und vor allem legen sie damit die Grundlage für die Probleme nachher, weil nämlich die Schulden ja weiter bedient werden müssen, auch wenn die Vermögenspreise gefallen sind. Und greifen Notenbanken dann ein, was sie eben seit über 30 Jahren machen, indem sie beispielsweise Zinsen senken oder Liquidität in die Märkte pumpen, dann würden sie zwar die akute Krise bekämpfen, das ist positiv, zugleich aber die Grundlage legen für den nächsten Boom und damit auch die nächste Krise.
As we've gotten into these periods of boom and then subsequent bust, and this goes back at least as far as 1987 with the Greenspan put, what has been different this time is that every time you've had a bust after the boom, the central banks in particular have come in with all guns blazing to try to stop the downside of the bust. And unfortunately, when they do that, of course, by easing monetary policy and in essence printing the money, they simply set the scene for another increase in credit and debt, which in turn also has a tendency to bust after the boom. And so it continues.
Und so geht es immer weiter, fast weiter Entwicklung zusammen. Durch die Bekämpfung der Krise legen die Notenbanken also die Grundlage für eine noch größere Krise. Und das gilt natürlich erst recht für die Zeit seit der Finanzkrise. Für White ist die Sache damit eindeutig. Die Notenbanken haben die Folgen der Finanzkrise mit denselben Instrumenten bekämpft, wie die Krisen davor, die im Prinzip zu der Krise überhaupt geführt haben. Und für ihn ist damit auch die Corona-Epidemie eigentlich nur ein Auslöser für eine neue Krise gewesen. Die Krise wäre eh gekommen. Es war ein Unfall, der passieren würde, aber es war unklar, was der Auslöser sein würde. Nun war es eben Corona.
You mentioned the bust that happened in 2008, the beginning of the great financial contraction. There we had an overextension in the financial system that was really extraordinary by previous historical standards. And of course, the reaction of the central banks was to do just what they did all the previous times, which is to lower interest rates as much as they had to and get the whole thing going again. And so when we wound up here in 2020 with the pandemic, my sense of it was that we were still further down an unsustainable path, and that in fact, it was another accident waiting to happen. And the pandemic just happened to be the trigger. So what we're seeing is really the culmination of a long, long period of what I consider to be misguided policies that rely too much on monetary policy to deal with problems that in fact have their roots in too much monetary policy.
Ja, wir leben in einer Welt, der missguided policy, der falschen Politik, die im Prinzip Krisen bekämpft, die durch die Geldpolitik erst ausgelöst wurden. Das muss man sich vor die Augen führen, wie stark diese Aussage ist von jemandem, der ja nun wirklich, ja, wie gesagt, 50 Jahre seines Lebens in diesem Bereich tätig war. Und für White ist die Schlussfolgerung eindeutig. Wir sind schon sehr, sehr lange, zu lange auf dem falschen Weg und wir scheinen uns irgendwie dann doch dem Ende des Weges zu nähern.
We've been on a bad path for a long period of time. It may well be now that the central bankers are increasingly aware of the fact that they're getting pretty close to the end of the path, which is to say the point at which monetary policy becomes effectively totally ineffective.
Tja, eine Welt, in der Geldpolitik nicht mehr wirksam ist. Und jetzt erinnern wir uns daran, wir haben es auch im Podcast schon diverse Mal diskutiert, dass die Rufe der Notenbanken, namentlich der EZB mit Frau Lagarde, immer lauter werden, dass wir doch endlich mehr Staatsausgaben haben sollen. Einfach deshalb, weil die Geldpolitik am Ende ist. Und auch wenn die EZB in dieser Woche weitere Maßnahmen beschlossen hat, ist eins ganz klar, diese Maßnahmen sind letztlich nicht mehr wirksam. Sie erreichen die Realwirtschaft nicht mehr. Weil natürlich für mich die naheliegende Frage war dem Motto, naja, wussten die das nicht besser oder wussten die das und haben es dann wieder besseren Wissens gemacht? Und da verweist William White in unserem Gespräch darauf, er sagt, letztlich sind Notenbanker auch nur Menschen. Wer gesteht schon gerne ein, dass er Fehler gemacht hat?
One of the difficulties, I mean, again, this is human nature, is that once you've done what you've done vigorously enough and long enough, it becomes almost impossible psychologically to say, oh, shucks, I think we made a mistake there. Let's go back and start all over again. There's all sorts of stories about to illustrate that particular human weakness.
Notenbanker sind auch nur Menschen, das mag schon stimmen, aber sie tragen eine besondere Verantwortung, würde ich ergänzen. Und deshalb wäre meine Erwartung schon, dass sie die Notenbanken entsprechend auch Selbstkritik stellen sollten oder Kritik stellen sollten und in der Lage sein sollten, wenn sie auf falschem Wege sind, diesen zu korrigieren. Offensichtlich waren sie es allerdings nicht. Und dann ging es im Gespräch zwischen Herrn White und mir um die Frage, was denn die Nebenwirkungen dieser Geldpolitik sind. Wir hatten Zombifizierung schon mehrfach als Thema in diesem Podcast. Und da sagt William White klar, es gibt einen Zusammenhang von billigem Geld und Zombifizierung. Vor allem weist er darauf hin, dass die tiefen Zinsen auch die Kapitalkraft der Banken erodieren lassen. Einfach deshalb, weil sie weniger Geld verdienen und es damit den Banken schwerer wird, Abschreibungen zu verkraften. Das heißt, tiefe Zinsen erodieren die Kapitalkraft der Banken und damit deren Fähigkeit, Zombies den Stecker zu ziehen. Und dann haben wir wieder den Punkt, den wir im Podcast schon diskutiert haben. Wir haben Zombie-Banken, die Zombie-Unternehmen stützen.
I think the broader point is that easy money and credit conditions create a lot of unintended consequences. In part, I mean, all of these things are interlinked. The reason we have zombies is because banks in particular are afraid to put the zombies to death because they, the banks, don't have enough capital to take the hit. The point is that if you have very easy monetary policy, the lower the interest rates go, the greater the tendency for the lending margins to shrink. And therefore, the more vulnerable becomes the financial sector. And the more vulnerable they are, the less capable they are of pulling the pin on the zombie companies, because they will take a big hit and they can't afford to take the hit. Or they worry that the financial markets will think they can't take the hit and there'll be a run in the bank. So it's the easy way out again. Let's pretend and extend. The implications of easy money for financial stability more broadly, I think, are very important. And I think they've been underestimated. There's a piece in the FT today, actually, where somebody was saying, well, the financial sector looks healthy. I don't think so.
Tja, das Finanzsystem ist eben nicht gesund, meint William White. Es ist im Prinzip durch das billige Geld zurzeit ein bisschen verdeckt, das Problem. Aber wir haben die Zombifizierung. Und wenn er recht hat mit seiner Einschätzung, dass das Finanzsystem eben nicht gesund ist, ist das gerade für die Eurozone eine sehr schlechte Nachricht. Denn gerade in Europa haben die Banken in den letzten Jahren gelitten unter der Geldpolitik und gelitten unter der Tatsache, dass eben im Unterschied zu den USA keine Rekapitalisierung nach der Finanzkrise stattgefunden hat und sie deshalb immer noch auf erheblichen faulen Krediten sitzen, auch wenn sie diese nicht offen ausweisen. Das war auch ein weiterer Aspekt, den wir besprochen haben, nämlich die Frage, wie sich eigentlich die Rolle der Notenbanken verändert hat. Denn wir erinnern uns, eigentlich sind Notenbanken ja gegründet worden, um als Kreditgeber der letzten Instanz zu funktionieren. Also es war so, Bank of England, damals war ganz klar, wenn eine Bank Schwierigkeiten hat, dann bekommt sie Hilfe unter zwei Voraussetzungen. Erste Voraussetzung ist, sie ist noch solvent. Das heißt, sie ist eigentlich gesund, aber hat gerade einen Liquiditätsengpass. Und zum Zweiten, es ist sehr, sehr teuer. Und was die Notenbanken in den letzten Jahren gemacht haben, haben sie ja umgekehrt. Sie haben im Prinzip immer gerettet, zu immer günstigeren Konditionen, also nicht teuer gemacht, also nicht bestraft. Und zum Zweiten haben sie ja auch die Solvenzkriterien gesenkt und dürften wahrscheinlich zunehmend auch Banken Geld geben, die eigentlich nicht wirklich solvent sind. Damit aber nicht genug. Die Rolle hat sich auch im anderen Aspekt geändert, meint William White, denn sie wären nicht nur der Kreditgeber der letzten Instanz, sondern sie würden immer mehr auch zu einem Marktmacher werden. Das heißt, sie stehen ein für die Entwicklung an den Börsen.
As you look at it over the decades, we're moving further and further into a world where the safety net being provided by the central banks is getting bigger and bigger. As the markets, as opposed to financial institutions, as financial markets became more important as providers of credit, that the safety net provisions provided by central banks, which is more or less lender of last resort, would turn into market maker of last resort. And that's precisely where we've gone.
Im Gespräch führt er dann weiter aus, was das bedeutet. Das bedeutet konkret, dass die Notenbanken am Markt direkt Finanzassets kaufen, also Anleihen, ja auch in einigen Märkten bereits Aktien, ich denke an den japanischen Markt, aber eben auch Anleihen von schlechten Schuldnern. Zum Beispiel die US-Notenbank Fed hat in der aktuellen Krise angefangen, Fonds zu kaufen von schlechten Schuldnern, also von Junk-Bonds. Auch das völlig undenkbar noch vor wenigen Jahren. Das heißt, die Notenbanken sind in einer Welt, wo sie quasi gerade stehen dafür, dass Vermögenspreise nicht fallen. Übrigens auch ein weiterer Grund für die Diskussion zum Thema Ungleichheit. Wir sprachen dann über die Frage, was denn die Regulierung tun kann. Weil wir haben in den letzten Jahren ja versucht, nicht wir, aber die Politiker haben versucht, in den letzten Jahren durch vermehrte Regulierung das Finanzsystem sicherer zu machen, krisenfester zu machen. Für William White ist es ein widersinniges Unterfangen, denn man würde mit dem einen Fuß fest auf der Bremse stehen, mit der Regulierung nämlich, während man mit dem anderen Fuß der Geldpolitik Vollgas gibt.
It does seem very strange to me that the central bankers have, you know, had their foot firmly on the accelerator for the last 10 years and the regulatory apparatus has got its foot firmly on the brake. So if you are driving a BMW at speed in that particular fashion, you know, you wouldn't be at all surprised if something would go wrong here because we're keeping on the road here net as a product of two very large gross numbers. So the brake and the accelerator.
Das Auto, also in diesem Beispiel also ein BMW, bleibt als Ergebnis zwar auf der Straße, aber dies, weil zwei sehr gegensätzliche Kräfte auf das Auto einwirken, nämlich eben Vollgas und Bremsen. Und das ist sicherlich weder effizient noch nachhaltig, würde ich da ergänzen. Womit wir uns auch den Folgen der Politik nähern. Wir wissen ja, dass die Notenbankpolitik auch dazu beigetragen hat, dass die Verschuldung weltweit immer mehr gestiegen ist. Ist ja klar, wenn die Schuldner das Signal bekommen, sie werden immer gerettet und es wird immer günstiger bei der Rettung, ist es klar, dass man Schulden macht. Und damit werden diese Schulden aber auch zu einer immer größeren Last auch für die Realwirtschaft. Und für White steht fest, dass die Verschuldung eben die Anfälligkeit des Systems deutlich erhöht. Und er erklärt dann, dass geringes Wachstum die Schuldentragfähigkeit mindert. Das heißt, wenn eine Wirtschaft nicht wächst, dann ist es schwer, Schulden zu bedienen. Wir können das ganz konkret am Beispiel Italiens ja beobachten, die zwei seit fast 20 Jahren, also vor der Corona-Krise, einen sogenannten Primärüberschuss hatten, also einen Überschuss im Haushalt vor Zinszahlungen, aber trotzdem steigende Schuldenquoten, einfach deshalb, weil Wachstum nicht da war. Umgekehrt, wenn wir ein Szenario hätten mit höherem Wachstum, würden aber die Zinsen steigen Und höhere Zinsen wären wiederum für die Schuldner auch ein Problem. Das heißt, wenig Wachstum ist schlecht für Schuldner, aber viel Wachstum oder höheres Wachstum ist auch schlecht für Schuldner, weil sie in beiden Fällen in Probleme hineinkommen. Im ersten Fall verdienen sie nicht genug, im zweiten Fall steigen die Finanzierungskosten. Wir sind also in einer Falle, würde ich sagen.
I think that's what it comes down to, is that debt increases fragility in virtually every state of nature. If the economy continues to grow very slowly and interest rates stay very low, the debt levels, regardless of the fact that the debt service will stay relatively low, as those debt levels get higher and higher, there will be more and more aversion to investors investing in people with debt levels of that sort. If you get slow growth, high debt levels, not a good idea. If you get faster growth, then the interest rates go up. And so you may have more of a capacity to service the debt because your revenues are going up. But now the interest rates are going up and hitting you on the other side of the balance sheet. Either way, it seems to me, debt, particularly unproductive debt, and I think it's important to make that point, there's nothing wrong with debt as such, as long as the debt is used for some productive purpose that provides the means to service the debt. But it's when the debt is used for non-productive purposes that it becomes a burden, and as Chairman Greenspan put it, it starts to act as headwinds on future growth.
William White macht hier einen wichtigen Punkt. Er hat gesagt, Schulden sind nicht per se schlecht. Und das ist auch das, was ich im Podcast mehrmals gesagt habe. Es hängt davon ab, wofür man Schulden macht. Macht man Schulden, um zu konsumieren oder zu spekulieren oder vorhandene Vermögenswerte zu kaufen, wie beispielsweise Immobilien, ist das schlecht. Macht man Schulden, um damit zu investieren, neue Produktionskapazitäten zu schaffen, vielleicht auch im Dienstleistungsbereich neue Märkte zu entwickeln, dann ist das gut. Einfach deshalb, weil diese Schulden dazu führen, dass mehr produziert wird, mehr erwirtschaftet wird und damit auch die Fähigkeit geschaffen wird, um die Schulden zu bedienen. Ein ganz wichtiger Unterschied. Und wir haben in den letzten Jahren eben einen sehr, sehr starken Anstieg gehabt der nicht produktiven Schulden, während die produktiven Schulden relativ zur Wirtschaftsleistung weitgehend stabil geblieben sind. Was zur Frage natürlich führt, was sollen wir mit den vielen Schulden machen?
Wünschst du dir auch manchmal jemanden an deiner Seite, der dich vorbehaltlos unterstützt, dir den Rücken frei hält und im richtigen Moment einfach perfekt ist? Keine Sorge, wir reden hier nicht über Online-Dating, sondern über Online-Business. Und dafür ist Shopify die perfekte Lösung. Schon zehntausende deutsche Unternehmen vertrauen Shopify. Egal ob innovatives Startup oder traditionsreicher Familienbetrieb. Fritz Kohler zum Beispiel oder Reisintel, Otto Mohl, Sternglas, YFood und viele mehr. Shopify revolutioniert als Commerce-Plattform das Online-Geschäft von Millionen Unternehmen weltweit. Mit Shopify kannst du deine Produkte auf beliebigen Vertriebskanälen verkaufen, egal ob persönlicher POS auf Social-Media-Marktplätzen wie Facebook, Instagram oder eBay bis zur umfassenden E-Commerce-Plattform. Du kannst mit Shopify dein Geschäft verwalten und ausbauen, unkompliziert und rechtskonform zugleich. Du hast Zugang zu einer stetig wachsenden Auswahl der innovativsten Funktionen und zu einem zuverlässigen Kundenservice rund um die Uhr. Produkte präsentieren, Inventar verwalten, Bestellungen und Zahlungen reibungslos abwickeln. Shopify bietet dir alle Tools, die du brauchst, um dein Business zu managen und das an einem einzigen, vertrauten Ort. So kannst du dich auf das Wichtigste konzentrieren, dein Business. Teste Shopify kostenlos und bring dein Geschäft auf das nächste Level auf shopify.de. Made for Germany, powered by Shopify.
Und wir hatten ja in einem Podcast vor ein paar Wochen eine intensive Diskussion zum Thema Modern Monetary Theory. Deshalb lag es natürlich nahe, dass ich William White frage, ob er denn glaubt, dass unter Umständen die Modern Monetary Theory ein Instrument sein könnte, um das Problem der hohen Schulden zu lösen. White sieht MMT ausgesprochen kritisch. Zum einen weist er darauf hin, dass das, was MMT fordert, nämlich die großzügige Verschuldung des Staates, finanziert von den Notenbanken, ja faktisch schon passiert. Und er sagt, das passiert jetzt in Corona, das ist richtig, dass es passiert, wir müssen eine akute Krise bekämpfen, aber es passierte schon vorher und vor allem ist die Wahrscheinlichkeit hoch, dass es auch nachher passiert. Und da fürchtet er erhebliche negative Konsequenzen.
It is a danger. It is a danger because, as I understand it, it's the simplicity of it that is both so attractive and so dangerous. The attractiveness part is they're basically telling people to do what we're already doing. You know, they're basically saying the government should run big deficits, which indeed they are, and were even before the pandemic in many cases. They should run a big deficit, and the only thing to worry about is inflation, and that's easily controllable. Both of these propositions are wrong. Because we're working on the basis now of not just increases on the fiscal side, but ultra easy monetary policy almost forever. And as I said before, that ignores all of the problems of malinvestments and financial instability that arise from this kind of a monetary policy. So that stuff is totally ignored as far as I can tell. And the second thing that they ignore is the difficulties of managing inflation. They seem to assume that, you know, if they go a bit too far on the fiscal dominant side, you get a little inflation. Well, then we'll sort that out with a little bit of tax increases. But I'm strongly of the view that the proper model of how the economy works is it isn't simple and understandable and controllable. It's complex, it's adaptive, and it's highly nonlinear. This idea that you get inflation out of the box and then it can suddenly explode against the backdrop of fiscal dominance doesn't seem to be there. And yet when you read people like Sebastian Edwards about Latin America, his view is that modern monetary theory just seems to have totally ignored the history of what happened in that continent, which is fiscal dominance can get out of hand so easily. And once it is, it's very hard to put it back in the box. I mean, it's a bit like I was talking earlier on about the Fed and the central banks, you know, suddenly finding themselves trapped into doing what they have to do because nobody else is there to do it. A similar kind of thing is that what modern monetary theory seems to be telling us is, well, just do more of what you're doing already. It's right in the current circumstances to do more of what we were doing already. But to fail to recognize the dangers associated with doing that and trying to take some preemptive steps to ensure to the public that we're not going down the Weimar route one more time, to say you don't need to worry about that, I think is just totally wrong. It ignores all of the examples of history.
White is besonders skeptisch, was die Fähigkeit betrifft, Inflation zu managen. Ich erinnere daran, in dem Podcast mit Herrn Ehns. Herr Ehns hat ja MMT hier vorgestellt und positiv vorgestellt. Und er hat gemeint, kein Problem, wenn Inflation kommt, erhöhen wir einfach die Steuern und dann gibt es keine Inflation mehr. Und White sagt nach dem Motto, nee, guck mal in die Geschichtsbücher, guck nach Lateinamerika, das hat schlichtweg nicht funktioniert. Immer wenn es eine fiskalische Dominanz gibt, also wenn im Prinzip die Fiskalpolitik entscheidet, was gemacht wird, auch bei der Notenbank, immer dann kommt es zu höherer Inflation. Er sagt im Prinzip, wir wissen einfach, dass genau das nicht passieren wird. Es wird nicht den politischen Willen geben, sich der Inflation entgegenzustellen. War natürlich dann die Frage offen, na gut, also wir haben es gerade gesehen, rauswachsen geht nicht, haben wir diskutiert. Wir haben auch diskutiert, MMT wird nicht funktionieren. Was zur Frage führt, was kann man eigentlich machen gegen die vielen Schulden? Und schon im Jahr 2010 hatte William White in der Financial Times einen vielbeachteten Beitrag geschrieben, wo er gesagt hat, wir brauchen einen Plan B, um mit den Schulden umzugehen. Und die naheliegende Option ist natürlich Inflation. Und da weist er im Gespräch mit mir darauf hin, er sagt, erstens, offensichtlich ist es gar nicht so leicht, Inflation zu erzeugen. Denn seit 10 Jahren haben die Notenbanken nichts anderes probiert, als Inflation zu erzeugen. Und dann hat er gesagt, naja, und wenn wir sie dann bekommen, dann ist es eine sehr heroische Annahme zu glauben, man könne sie kontrollieren. Denn auch hier weist er wieder auf die Geschichte zurück, er weist sogar auf Weimar und sagt, man kriegt Inflation vielleicht, aber wenn man Inflation hat, wie kann man sicherstellen, dass sie nicht außer Kontrolle gerät? Darüber hinaus sagt er dann noch, naja, nach dem Zweiten Weltkrieg hatten wir das zwar, eine positive Kombination. Wir hatten relativ gute Wachstumsraten, wir hatten moderate Inflationsraten, aber durchaus gegebene Inflationsraten. Und das hat dazu geführt, dass die Staatsschuldenquoten relativ zur Wirtschaftsleistung deutlich gesunken sind. Und er sagt, heutzutage das zu machen, dürfe sehr schwer sein. Einfach deshalb, weil wir ja alle die Möglichkeit haben, mit einem Knopfdruck von unserem Computer einfach das Geld in eine andere Währung, in ein anderes Land zu überweisen. Und demzufolge haben wir viel mehr Fluchtmöglichkeiten, als das vor 80 Jahren der Fall war.
And then you're back into the practical problems, which is, one, can you get inflation up? And the answer is maybe yes, maybe no. We've been trying to do it now for 10 years without success. And secondly, if you do get it up, can you ensure that it stays at a moderate level against a backdrop of very high government debts? And the government holds the key to the printing presses. And so I don't have to tell a German audience that these things can get out of control very easily. And I mean, we've seen this so many times in Latin America, but even in post-war Germany, Hungary, I mean, we have many, many examples. When you think about financial repression, inflation is really a two-edged sword. The other side of it, of course, is that financial repression demands control over the interest rates. And then the question becomes, in the modern world, you know, where people can move huge amounts of money sort of at the flip of the switch, you know, from your PC or mine, can you get that control? And I think the answer is clearly not. And the mechanism for the hyperinflation is people flee the currency. We have a particular country, Venezuela, let's say, okay, Zambia, where the government is behaving very badly. The fiscal situation is terrible. Everyone can see the writing on the wall and they say, I am out of here. Fair enough. Okay, so the currency takes a huge decline. People try to get out. That sets off the crisis. What about a world in which everybody who is respectable is doing the same thing? So the US, Europe, Japan. Then this issue about financial repression, it takes on a bit of a different character. It may mean that that period of time in which you could have relatively high inflation and there was no place to go to, that's one that we haven't ever seen before. I suspect what it means is that this world of relatively higher inflation, but without everything totally falling apart, could go on for a much longer time period than we think.
Ein interessantes Szenario, wenn Europa, die USA, Japan, die großen Währungsräume, vielleicht auch Großbritannien, wenn die all dasselbe Problem haben und alle zum selben Instrumentarium greifen, dann gibt es gar keine Möglichkeit mehr, sich vor dieser Inflation zu schützen, indem man sein Geld ins Ausland überweist. Da sagt im Prinzip, wenn alle schlecht sind, dann spielt es keine Rolle, wenn ich schlecht bin. Da würde ich natürlich zu ergänzen, angesichts dieses Umfelds, in dem wir uns gerade befinden, spricht ziemlich viel für dieses Szenario. Und natürlich auch für die Notwendigkeit der Vorsorge für uns alle als Hörer dieses Podcasts, für alle Bürger Deutschlands und eigentlich auch für die deutsche Bundesregierung. Also ich würde sagen, naja, in einem Szenario, was unweigerlich auf eine Monetarisierung hinauslaufen muss, wäre es in der höchsten Zeit, dass die deutsche Bundesregierung daran arbeitet, die Vermögen der Deutschen zu sichern. Doch kommen wir zurück zum Thema Schuldenabbau. Gäbe es Alternativen, habe ich William White gefragt. Gäbe es ein anderes Szenario, um die Schuldenlast zu mindern? Und White kommt zu einer klaren Aussage. Er sagt, die Verluste durch die schlechten Kredite, die sind schon da. Die sind nur noch nicht realisiert. Wir sehen sie nur noch nicht. Und alles, was wir jetzt gerade erleben, ist die Frage, wer hinterher den Schaden hat. Wir reden im Prinzip mehr über die Verteilung des Schadens als über die Frage, ob der Schaden überhaupt da ist. Für ihn ist er definitiv da. Und er sagt dann dem Motto, naja, das Beste wäre ja, man würde sich zusammensetzen, würde geordnet einen Schuldenschnitt machen. Also im Prinzip, Gläubiger und Schuldner setzen sich zusammen, Beispiel Italien, und sagen, fein, die Staatsschulden sind so nicht tragbar, wir akzeptieren, dass wir nur 50 Cent für einen Euro zurückbekommen, Hauptsache wir bekommen überhaupt etwas zurück. Die Alternative, dass man spart und versucht zurückzuzahlen, sieht er definitiv nicht, einfach deshalb, weil es dazu führt, dass die Wirtschaft noch schneller schrumpft als zuvor. Das heißt, je mehr ich spare, desto höher ist die Schuldenlast.
If the problem is a debt overhang, debts that cannot be serviced at anything near sort of normal interest rates, which I guess I would put as a real rate more or less the same as the growth rate of the economy, those debts should be restructured or written off. As I put it, the money's gone. You know, it's just a question of how to allocate the losses. The money's gone. Now the question is, cut your losses. And what's the best way to do it? And my contention would be that an orderly set of debt restructurings is always, always less costly than a disorderly restructuring. And a disorderly restructuring is where countries, whole continents perhaps, hunker down, try to pay off the debts through austerity. And it's impossible because of the paradox of thrift.
Das Sparparadox besagt Folgendes. Je mehr die Bürger eines Landes sparen, desto geringer ist die Nachfrage und damit die Wirtschaftsleistung. Das heißt, die Wirtschaft schrumpft schneller und die Schuldenquoten gehen hoch. Das kann nur funktionieren, wenn man Waren ins Ausland liefert, so wie Deutschland in den letzten 10 Jahren. Das ist natürlich eine Lösung für ein Land, aber nicht für alle Länder gleichzeitig, weil wir können nicht alle einen Handelsüberschuss haben, solange wir den Mars nicht als Absatzmarkt eröffnen, würde ich jetzt ergänzen. Bleibt natürlich die Frage, wie soll es denn weitergehen, wenn wir die Schulden bereinigt haben? Also nehmen wir mal an, wir schaffen es jetzt, einen Schuldenschnitt zu organisieren oder aber die Inflation kommt. Wie stellen wir sicher, dass wir danach nicht wieder in dasselbe Muster verfallen, dass wir nicht wieder eine Welt haben von Aufschwung und Crash, von Boom und Bust, sondern im Prinzip sagen, wir kriegen eine stabilere Entwicklung? Und White nennt zunächst einfache Maßnahmen. Er sagt, die Notenbanken sollten präventive Zinsen erhöhen, wenn die Märkte überhitzen, also genau das Gegenteil von dem, was Greenspan gemacht hat. Sie sollten im Prinzip das Risiko an die Marktteilnehmer zurückgeben. Also wenn Banken schlechte Kredite geben, dann müssen sie für diese Konsequenz auch einstehen, nicht gerettet werden. Und er geht sogar so weit, dass er sagt, am liebsten sollten Banken wieder wie Partnerschaften geführt werden, die eben mit ihrem persönlichen Geld dafür haften und nicht große Aktiengesellschaften sein. Einfach im Sinne von, lasst die Entscheider die Konsequenzen der eigenen Handlungen tragen.
My conclusion is you'd start off by changing policy. And the first and most obvious thing to do is you'd use monetary policy to lean against booms and busts. And we don't do that at the moment. The next thing is you change behavior. So it's people, it's the lenders. It's the lenders that lose money. Those lenders, in most instances, and I'm not talking so much about pension fund here, but banks in particular, think about pre-European crisis banking. Those guys should have known better. They made loans to bad debtors. They knew what they were getting into and they got away unscathed. When I talk about changing behavior, you should change the laws, for example, to say that when people make egregiously bad loans in order to prop up their own asset prices, whatever, those people should go to jail. So that instead of fining banks, you know, taking out of the pockets of the shareholders, you should take it out of the lives of the people that did the bad lending. And of course, in the background, you always have the issue of, why don't you just raise the capital levels? And sort of look back 20 years and say, you know, we made a big mistake by letting banks become, traded on stock markets. They should be mutually held. A bank should have 12 partners, 12 men and women sitting around a table, basically saying, this is my money and your money. Well, this gets you back into the next sort of on my list, which of course is things like free banking, narrow banking. And in free banking, as I understand it, you know, they basically say, get rid of all the safety nets. They're all gone. All the safety nets, all the regulations. It just, it induces bad behavior. And then what you will have is, one, people will know it's their money, you know, that they're going to have to try to conserve. But you'll have all the other banks looking at any one bank that behaves badly and saying, we're not going to lend to you, interbank market, whatever, because we think you're behaving badly and your bad behavior will eventually cause problems for us. The system will be stable. The narrow banking thing, as you know, basically says, well, banks will only be able to invest in treasury bonds. So all of the risky stuff will all be done by mutual funds and people will know the risks that they're taking and they'll take them. That's the way it'll work. And in that world, again, you'd get rid of regulation and you'd get rid of safety nets because you wouldn't need them. It's the same as with free banking, but in free banking, getting rid of regulation and the safety net is a prerequisite to free banking. Whereas in narrow banking, getting rid of safety nets and regulation is a byproduct. So you get to the same place, but for very different reasons.
Es geht weit im Kern darum, dem System das Risiko zurückzugeben. Wenn Banken das Risiko haben, dass andere Banken ihnen kein Geld mehr leihen, weil sie so ein aggressives Geschäftsgebaren haben, werden sie es nicht so weit kommen lassen. Wenn Banker Kredite vergeben und das Risiko laufen, für Verluste persönlich gerade stehen zu müssen, werden sie vorsichtiger sein bei der Kreditvergabe. Und vielleicht noch ganz kurz ein Hinweis, mit Free Banking und Narrow Banking, damit beschreibt White einfach die zwei Eckpunkte, wie Banken reguliert sein könnten. Free im Sinne von gar nicht und Narrow ganz eng. Aber im Kern ist es natürlich so, sobald ich das Risiko zurückgebe, sobald Banken pleite gehen können wegen falscher Kreditvergabe, ist es egal, was für ein Bankensystem man hat. Man hat auf jeden Fall viel weniger Risiko. Dr. White, I'm extremely pleased to talk to you over Zoom for my podcast. And my starting question would really be, if you look back at the financial crisis, and you are supposedly one of the persons or the few people who predicted the financial crisis already before it happened, could you explain to us why we got into this crisis? Why did the financial crisis actually happen?
Well, financial crises happen all the time, of course. I mean, if you go back in history, for thousands of years, they have recurred, not with any specific regularity, but we do get them all the time. And what they appear to be associated with mostly, as far as I can tell, is some element of good news that leads to an increased demand for credit, and then a greater willingness on the part of the credit providers to provide it. And as consistent with human nature, everything sort of gets carried away so that things that in the first instance were sensible, then you get financed for things that are not so sensible. And so it carries on until people get to a point where it becomes clear that the debts that they've taken out are not capable of being serviced or even repaid. And then you get a panic and then the whole thing collapses and you start again. What's sort of interesting about this most recent set of events is that policy has intervened in a way that either couldn't have happened or didn't happen in the past. And what I mean by that is that as we've gotten into these periods of boom and then subsequent bust, and this goes back at least as far as 1987 with the Greenspan put, what has been different this time is that every time you've had a bust after the boom, the central banks in particular have come in with all guns blazing to try to stop the downside of the bust. And unfortunately, when they do that, of course, by easing monetary policy and in essence printing the money, they simply set the scene for another increase in credit and debt, which in turn also has a tendency to bust after the boom. And so it continues. I guess, you know, you mentioned the bust that happened in 2008, the beginning of the great financial contraction. Well, there we had an overextension in the financial system that was really extraordinary by previous historical standards. And of course, the reaction of the central banks was to do just what they did all the previous times, which is to lower interest rates as much as they had to and get the whole thing going again. And so when we wound up here in 2020 with the pandemic, my sense of it was that we were still further down an unsustainable path, and that in fact it was another accident waiting to happen. And the pandemic just happened to be the trigger. So what we're seeing is really the culmination of a long, long period of what I consider to be misguided policies that rely too much on monetary policy to deal with problems that in fact have their roots in too much monetary policy.
Are the central banks more like the sorcerer's apprentice? They created a problem which they don't get under control anymore.
I think there's an element of truth in that. It is difficult because the argument that the central bankers would use, I think going back to 1987, if not beyond, is that, in fact, easy money works in moderating the Han by the busts after the boom. It works. And so if it works, why wouldn't you do it again? But the problem is that every time that you do it, you're creating yet more debt on the basis of the debts that you had before. And so you're making a cure even more difficult. But up until now, the cure has always worked. And so there has been a tendency to say, well, let's just do it again.
Was it a cure or wasn't it more like buying time? Because a cure would for me mean you get healthy afterwards. But absolutely, what you're describing actually is it gets worse. It's like pain relief, but the true issue of the pain is still there.
You're absolutely right. And this is the distinction that I've made really throughout my career about crises. There are three elements. There's crisis prevention, there's crisis management, and then there's crisis resolution. And the crisis resolution basically says, we're out of this thing, we're cured. Whereas the management is really sort of a treatment of the symptoms and keeping the symptoms under control. And that's really not good enough. But that, in fact, is what has been going on. And as I say, what makes it even worse, back to the sorcerer's apprentice, is that the management has made the likelihood of a future problem even greater. We've been on a bad path for a long period of time, but we haven't yet come to the end of that path. It may well be now that the central bankers are increasingly aware of the fact that they're getting pretty close to the end of the path, which is to say the point at which monetary policy becomes effectively totally ineffective. But in a sense, it would have been better if people had changed the path earlier, as opposed to only saying we must get off the path when it is patently obvious that you've come to the end of the path. But here we are.
Didn't they know what they were doing? Was it really an accident, or did central bankers act a little bit like politicians, like let's postpone the problem for our successor?
Well, you know, honestly, I don't know. There's two hypotheses. One of them is that the central bankers have done what they did because they truly believed that it would work to re-stimulate aggregate demand at a time when demand was in short supply. They really believed that it would work and that it wouldn't have any important side effects. That's one hypothesis. Second hypothesis is that they really sort of got sucked into it. And what I mean by that, let's say go back to 2007, 2008, and you have a huge crisis in the financial markets, and the central bankers step in the interests of financial stability, right? And they lower the interest rates and they make central bank credit more available. And then, while they're still in that mode, And this is what happened in 2009, 2010. Fiscal policy, instead of sort of also leaning against the downturn, turns to austerity. And you certainly know what I'm talking about in the European case. So the fiscal policy turns to austerity. The regulators, without having resolved the problem within the financial system, then start taking measures to prevent another crisis, which is perfectly legitimate. But the measures to prevent another crisis are actually also acting against aggregate demand. They're making it tougher to get credit. So now you've got the regulatory policy in disinflationary mode. You've got fiscal policy working in the same direction. Now, monetary policy is the only game in town. You know that expression?
Yeah, of course.
And so the central bankers get drawn into doing more of what they were doing before. But here's the subtle point, is that they're now doing what they did before, which is easy money, not for the purposes of reestablishing financial stability, okay, and dealing with the problems within the financial markets, but they're now doing it for a totally different purpose, which is to stimulate aggregate demand in the hopes of going back to full employment, et cetera, et cetera. So you can see how, in a sense, under the set of circumstances where everybody else is tightening and the central bankers are left alone to pursue, foster increased aggregate demand, and they're actually being asked to do just more of what they've already been doing that everybody said was a good idea. Okay, so you can see it's not so hard for them to get drawn down that particular path. One of the difficulties, I mean, again, this is human nature, is that once you've done what you've done vigorously enough and long enough, it becomes almost impossible psychologically to say, oh, shucks, I think we made a mistake there. Let's go back and start all over again. There's all sorts of stories about to illustrate that particular human weakness.
Well, you know, if you speak about the end of the road, obviously, in the past years, as you pointed out, particularly in Europe, we had austerity, we had fiscal austerity, but we had the European Central Bank trying to push aggregate demand. And we've seen, I would say, probably failure. You would probably say, okay, failure is a bit exaggerated, but it really didn't work out. You know, we didn't have high growth rates. We had an output gap already before Corona. You know, the growth rates were disappointing. Even in the US, they were disappointing. Also, Donald Trump had a huge deficit. Basically, the logic of stimulating aggregate demand via central bank policy doesn't work anymore in a world which has too much debt.
As I would describe it, there's a kind of fundamental intertemporal inconsistency that you do what you do in terms of monetary easing, as I said before, and at the beginning it works well. But after a period of time, because of the buildup of debt associated with that easy monetary policy, it works less well. And in the end, and maybe that's where we've gotten to at the moment, it doesn't work at all. And of course, there's all sorts of side effects of ultra easy money.
One of the main side effects is zombification. And we have a long discussion, you know, we're having a creating of zombies, and your former employer, the Bank Financial Settlements, they published several studies showing that the share of zombie companies have gone up. And there was a recent paper showing that in Europe, zombies are the main cause for low inflation, which for me intuitively is clear because they generate overcapacity. A zombie needs liquidity and not profits, therefore selling over the price. What's your view there? Is this one of the key issues that we say cheap money, preventing crisis, keeps companies alive, zombification leads to more deflation, leads to lower productivity growth, increases the need for aggregate demand stimulus, increases the need for even cheaper money? Would you follow down this path? Would you say, well, that's a too negative assessment?
Well, it's probably too negative, but honestly, I've been drawn in that direction, and I've written about this, sort of the extreme case, which is one of easy money leading to a Hayekian term, malinvestments, leading in turn to lower productivity growth and slower growth overall. Now, slower growth overall if that's what's happening to potential, ought not to be an excuse for easier money, because this is potential slower. But you can imagine it would be very easy, because very easy for central bankers to get that one wrong, because it's so hard to measure potential. So potential, you know, as you know, is mostly sort of, you know, fitted polynomials through past experience. So it's very hard to know. So it's not implausible that faced with slow growth, which the central bankers would say somehow was not supply but demand driven, for them to ease monetary policy still further, thus causing slower supply, increasingly ineffective in increasing aggregate demand, but perhaps increasingly effective in decreasing aggregate supply, I think has been well documented. It's not just the BIS. In fact, I would say most of the really interesting early work on this was done by WP1 at the OECD when I was still there at the OECD, working at the OECD. They've all sorts of papers written by the OECD on this. And of course, the BIS, and increasingly, I think the fund is realizing that this is an issue as well. But in a way, it does go back to this very old sort of Austrian concept of malinvestments.
And it's the same also with, because the other side effect we always discuss is asset prices. That's another way of malinvestments. So that asset prices go up. Yeah. So central banks are...
Yeah. I'll be honest with you. I've always been a bit sort of worried about focusing on asset prices as such. And one of the reasons for that is that going back in time when I was at the BIS, and I'm talking now about the late 1990s, you know, even before the Great Contraction, we were talking about asset prices and misalignment of asset prices, equities in particular, from the underlying fundamentals. This really goes back to the TMT stuff, remember, in the equities at the end of the 1990s and the, you know, the media technology bubble. The response we always got from the Fed was, you talk about asset prices being misaligned. Well, which asset price are you talking about? And how do you know it's misaligned? You know, where the theory is pretty shaky. And you get in, the danger is it becomes a kind of straw man. I think the broader point is that easy money and credit conditions create a lot of unintended consequences. And there's a whole pile of them having to do with the financial sector. And I mean, you were earlier on talking about zombies. In part, I mean, all of these things are interlinked. The reason we have zombies is because banks in particular are afraid to put the zombies to death because they, the banks, don't have enough capital to take the hit. And they don't have enough capital.
Yeah, zombies as well. Huh? You've got zombie banks and zombie companies.
Yeah, zombie companies and zombie banks. Ben Bernanke actually wrote a piece about this back in the 1980s. So it's sort of funny that he didn't pick up on it. But anyway, the point is that if you have very easy monetary policy, the lower the interest rates go, the greater the tendency for the lending margins to shrink. And therefore, the more vulnerable becomes the financial sector. And the more vulnerable they are, the less capable they are of pulling the pin on the zombie companies, because they will take a big hit and they can't afford to take the hit. Or they worry that the financial markets will think they can't take the hit and there'll be a run in the bank. So it's the easy way out again. Let's pretend and extend. So the implications of easy money for financial stability more broadly, I think, are very important. And I think they've been underestimated. There's a piece in the FT today, actually, where somebody was saying, well, the financial sector looks healthy. I don't think so, because you have these squeezed margins, squeezed profits, asset prices that are misaligned with the fundamentals, and there's losses coming down the road when the asset prices realign themselves with the fundamentals. There's no price discovery. You know, we saw this in Japan for some day, Some weeks it'd be days in a row where there'd be no private sector transactions in JGBs. Price discovery disappears. Everything becomes risk on, risk off, you know, so that all the benefits of value investing, portfolio diversification, it all disappears. The only thing that's important is, do you think the central bank's actions will work or not? We've had all of these flash crashes in the financial markets, all these continuing anomalies, some combination of easy money and regulatory developments. The banks are no longer willing or capable of putting up the capital to do the arbitrage to make the condition apply. So there's all sorts of stuff going on there. And you see the culmination of it, I mean, to me at least, in what happened in the U.S. Treasury market, you know, last September. And then nothing much happened in December, but then it happened again in March. And then you have the Fed having to come in and pull out all the stops, right down to indicating a willingness to buy exchange-traded funds that include corporates that have been lowered to junk status. As you look at it over the decades, we're moving further and further into a world where the safety net being provided by the central banks is getting bigger and bigger.
Yeah, junk bond funds, yeah.
And I actually wrote a big piece about this in 2004. It was a BIS working paper, and it was called "Are Changes in Financial Markets Extending Safety Nets?" And it really had to do with the idea that as the markets, as opposed to financial institutions, as financial markets became more important as providers of credit, that the safety net provisions provided by central banks, which is more or less lender of last resort, would turn into market maker of last resort. Mm-hmm. And that's precisely where we've gone.
Lender of last resort. You know, when we look back into history, it was, Walter Bateshot said it, lender of last resort means you lend money only to institutions which are solvent and not just a liquidity problem, and you do so at punitive rates. Yeah. My understanding is actually central banks are doing the opposite. They are lending money not at punitive rates, but cheaper, 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 and they are probably more generous in interpreting who is still solvent and who is not.
Well, this is gets us back to something we were talking about earlier on, which is using the same instruments, but using them for different purposes. So when you talk, for example, about, you know, the LTRO, now what is the long-term?
It's a long-term lending of the ECB to the banks, in very simple terms. Yeah. It's a long-term credit to the financial facility.
Yeah, with increasingly subsidized rates to the banks that are prepared to make loans at ever lower rates. Now we're no longer talking about financial stability and lender of last resort. We're talking about something which is explicitly designed to stimulate lending and aggregate demand.
And increasing risk-taking.
And increased risk-taking, absolutely. And I might point out, at the same time, as you've got a regulatory regime which seems intent on reducing risk-taking. So this is another aspect of it that I've been sort of going on about recently, which is it does seem very strange to me that the central bankers had their foot firmly on the accelerator for the last 10 years, and the regulatory apparatus has got its foot firmly on the brake. So if you are driving a BMW at speed in that particular fashion, you wouldn't be at all surprised if something...
something goes wrong, yes.
Something would go wrong here because we're keeping on the road here net. As a product of two very large gross numbers.
But it's a case, you know, the brakes would burn down, I would assume, if you do this with a car. The same should not happen in a certain sense, of course, of the financial system. Well, it should not, but the risk is there.
Yeah, for sure.
But one of the biggest side effects of the central bank policy of the past 30 years is the increased level of debt. So obviously, and the higher the debt level, the more fragile is the economic system and the more intervention is needed. That's what I take out of our conversation.
I think in a nutshell, I think that's what it comes down to, is the debt increases fragility in virtually every state of nature. Think about sort of the current circumstances, for example. If the economy continues to grow very slowly and interest rates stay very low, the debt levels, regardless of the fact that the debt service will say relatively low, as those debt levels get higher and higher, there will be more and more aversion to investors investing in people with debt levels of that sort. And we're seeing this already with the triple Bs in the States and whatever. So if you get slow growth, high debt levels, not a good idea. If you get faster growth, then the interest rates go up. And so you may have more of a capacity to service the debt because your revenues are going up. But now the interest rates are going up and hitting you on the other side of the balance sheet. So either way, it seems to me, debt, particularly unproductive debt, and I think it's important to make that point. We go back again to malinvestments and misallocation. There's nothing wrong with debt as such, as long as the debt is used for some productive purpose that provides the means to service the debt. But it's when the debt is used for non-productive purposes that it becomes a burden, and as Chairman Greenspan put it, it starts to act as headwinds on future growth.
Yes, like the real estate markets are driven by cheaper and cheaper money, higher and higher valuations.
Yeah.
And of course, people being highly leveraged, when asset prices drop, the whole system is bankrupt. It's not only the person who took on the loan, but the banks get bankrupt, the whole system is bankrupt.
Absolutely.
But what to do about the debt? Already in 2010, you wrote an article in the Financial Times, you know, we need a plan B to deal with the debt levels in a certain sense. And
as long ago as that?
It's 10 years ago. And the question here is, you know, what should we do about the debt now? Because raising interest rates, we get a depression. Increasing equity demand for lending, asset prices drop, we get a depression. If you really want to deal with a problem, most probably we have to go through a severe economic downturn. And this is, I think, politically not a good option. So if I were, you know, Chancellor of Germany, I would not be very pleased.
No, absolutely.
And the central banker who does this is also not very popular. So what do you do to deal with the debt?
Well, in theory, there's four things you can do. One thing you can do is austerity. But I just put forward my first witness, Greece.
Or Italy. You can also take Italy.
Yeah. Austerity is, this is where you get into what they call the Keynesian paradox of thrift. It's if a household has spent too much, well, then the household should cut back its expenditures. And the problem, of course, for a whole economy is that if one person cuts back, it's somebody else's revenues. And so in the end, the paradox of thrift that Keynes identified was the whole economy tries to save more, but by reducing the overall size of the economy, you ultimately wind up saving less. So the paradox of thrift. So that doesn't work. Second thing you said, why don't you grow out of it? Okay, so we need faster growth. But this is almost, you know, self-contradictory because the problem that we're dealing with is debt, which is a headwind preventing growth. There's all these other structural reforms that you can think of, you know, and there's low-hanging fruit virtually everywhere. But it's hard to believe that those kinds of supply-side reforms can increase growth enough to say this problem is behind us. So that's not going to work either. Then I guess the third thing that you could think of is inflation, which is basically what happened after World War II. But it's got to be a very particular kind of inflation. So it's got to be inflation without interest rates going up. Because otherwise, we're back again to the interest rates go up and you're back in the problem that you were trying to avoid. So they coined this phrase financial repression after World War II. And basically the message was get inflation up, but use administrative means to prevent the interest rates from rising. And what happens then that is in real terms, the debts just get eaten away year after year. The numbers are pretty huge. I mean, you know, the annual losses on ownerships of gilts in the UK was 5% per annum. Long bondholders in holders of long bonds in France was 8 or 9% per annum. You don't need too many years like that before the problem goes away.
Well, you know, but given current debt levels, I would say it takes 10 to 15 years, 20 years in some cases.
It could well be. And then you're back into the practical problems, which is, one, can you get inflation up? And the answer is maybe yes, maybe no. We've been trying to do it now for 10 years without success. And secondly, if you do get it up, can you ensure that it stays at a moderate level against a backdrop of very high government debts? And the government holds the key to the printing presses. And so I don't have to tell a German audience that these things can get out of control very easily. And I mean, we've seen this so many times in Latin America, but even in post-war Germany, Hungary, I mean, we have many, many examples. So when you think about financial repression, inflation is really a two-edged sword. The other side of it, of course, is that financial repression demands control over the interest rates. And then the question becomes, in the modern world, you know, where people can move huge amounts of money sort of at flip of the switch, you know, from your PC or mine, can you get that control? And I think the answer is clearly not.
Yeah, you mean the capital controls and abolishing private ownership of gold and capital controls is used to work 80 years back, but it doesn't work anymore. That's what you say, basically.
Yeah, I think it would be very hard. Now, having said that, there's an interesting wrinkle that your listeners might want to reflect upon, is that when you go back and you look at the history of hyperinflations or high inflations and hyperinflations, there's a book which I recommend to anybody by Peter Bernholtz, which is called Monetary Regimes and Inflation. Peter was professor emeritus at the University of Basel. Most of the examples that are in there really have to do with single countries. And the mechanism for the hyperinflation is people flee the currency. So we have a particular country, Venezuela, let's say, okay, Zambia, where the government is behaving very badly. The fiscal situation is terrible. Everyone can see the writing on the wall and they say, I am out of here. Fair enough. Okay. So the currency takes a huge decline. People try to get out. That sets off the crisis. What about a world in which everybody who is respectable is doing the same thing? So the U.S., Europe, Japan, then this issue about financial repression, it takes on a bit of a different character because you, and I haven't thought my way through this, but it may mean that that period of time in which you could have relatively high inflation and there was no place to go to.
Nowhere to hide.
That's one that we haven't ever seen before. And I suspect what it means, although I could be wrong here, I suspect what it means is that this world of relatively higher inflation, but without everything totally falling apart, could go on for a much longer time period than we think.
Yeah, but isn't it already, from a conceptual point of view, starting to be prepared? If you look back before Corona, there was already the discussion around helicopter money, about central banks should finance the central banks directly for the next crisis. No one expected Corona, but there was a worry about what do we do with the next recession when we're already entering the recession with negative rates in Europe, for example. So we have ideas. Let's take the first idea. Modern monetary theory. Our listeners are familiar with the theory. I had a few episodes on it. I even spoke with someone who is a very strong supporter. And basically, they say, well, you know, all money, the government debt creates its own money anyhow. It's double bookkeeping, which to my understanding also seems to be a correct assessment. And they say, so it doesn't matter. We print our money. And as long as there's no inflation, there's no problem. And when there's inflation, we just raise taxes. So is MMT, and because it's also very popular now with the Democratic new president elect, is MMT now the conceptual framework bringing us to the new world of higher inflation?
It is a danger. It is a danger because, as I understand it, it's the simplicity of it that is both so attractive and so dangerous. The attractiveness part is they're basically telling people to do what we're already doing. You know, they're basically saying the government should run big deficits, which indeed they are, and were even before the pandemic in many cases. They should run a big deficit, and the only thing to worry about is inflation, and that's easily controllable. And I guess what I would say is that both of these propositions are wrong, because we're working on the basis now of not just increases on the fiscal side, but ultra easy monetary policy almost forever. And as I said before, that ignores all of the problems of malinvestments and financial instability that arise from this kind of a monetary policy. So that stuff is totally ignored as far as I can tell. And the second thing that they ignore is the difficulties of managing inflation. They seem to assume that, you know, if they go a bit too far on the fiscal dominant side, you get a little inflation. Well, then we'll sort that out with a little bit of tax increases. But as you know from reading my stuff, I'm strongly of the view that the proper model of how the economy works is it isn't simple and understandable and controllable. It's complex, it's adaptive, and it's highly nonlinear. This idea that you get inflation out of the box and then it can suddenly explode against the backdrop of fiscal dominance doesn't seem to be there. And yet when you read people like Sebastian Edwards, you know, who's written for years about Latin America, his view is that modern monetary theory just seems to have totally ignored the history of what happened in that continent, which is fiscal dominance can get out of hand so easily. And once it is, it's very hard to put it back in the box. I mean, it's a bit like I was talking earlier on about the Fed and the central banks suddenly finding themselves trapped into doing what they have to do because nobody else is there to do it. A similar kind of thing is that what modern monetary theory seems to be telling us is, well, just do more of what you're doing already.
Mm-hmm. More aggressive, yeah.
It's right in the current circumstances to do more of what we were doing already. But to fail to recognize the dangers associated with doing that and trying to take some preemptive steps to ensure to the public that we're not going down the Weimar route one more time, you know, to say you don't need to worry about that, I think is just totally wrong. It ignores all of the examples of history. I know they don't teach economic history much anymore, nor the history of economic thought, but my view is that they should do.
I just try to imagine if I know where, I don't know, Mrs. Lagarde, and I, okay, we probably might have some special issues with the euro, but I follow you. We've done this for 30 years in central banks, and we are basically now in the end game. The interest rates are negative already in Europe. They will become negative in the UK. They might become negative in the US. So there's some more stuff to go. And then Japan, Europe, US, UK, all negative. We all buy up assets. The debt levels are very high. People start to speculate even more. Probably people even take on credit because they now really expect inflation to come. And they say, I'd rather buy a house on credit before inflation comes. So we have probably even an additional spike in asset price inflation. But we have no solution.
One has to be cognizant of the dangers associated with it. If the problem is a debt overhang, debts that cannot be serviced at anything near sort of normal interest rates, which I guess I would put as a real rate more or less the same as the growth rate of the economy, those debts should be restructured or written off. As I put it, the money's gone. You know, it's just a question of how to allocate the losses. The money's gone.
Yeah, but then, you know, we've got the pension funds and we've got life insurance companies, and basically it's to save us.
Absolutely.
So normal people are losing money.
I know, I understand. And it's not like people talk about debt jubilee, but when you go back to the Bible, you know, the debt jubilee was the king and a few of the people around him forgave the debts of these wage slaves, okay, and allowed them to get their wives and children back at home again. But it didn't change the lifestyle of the king and the courtiers. The big difference today is that that debt is widely held by pension funds and all sorts of other people. But it doesn't deny the fact that if the debts cannot be serviced, the money is gone. And somebody is going to have to take the hit. You know, as I'm fond of saying, it's not a question of losses to come. The losses are already there. We just don't know it. We don't want to accept it. But, you know, in the old days, guys like Bill Rhodes, you know, when Brazil or Argentina had a real problem and they'd been lent money by 20 big banks, Bill Rhodes would get them into a room in New York, as I understand it, and lock the door and basically say, gentlemen, you have a choice. Do you want 50 cents on the dollar or do you want nothing? Okay? Because 100 cents on the dollar is not on the table. The money's gone. Now, the question is, cut your losses. And what's the best way to do it? And my contention would be that an orderly set of debt restructurings is always, always less costly than a disorderly restructuring. And a disorderly restructuring is where countries, whole continents perhaps, hunker down, try to pay off the debts through austerity, and it's impossible because of the paradox of thrift.
So, but let's assume we find a solution for debt restructuring. Debt restructuring is done.
Yeah.
Can we somehow escape this boom-bust cycle? You spoke about productive debt being good. Productive debt still requires growth. And you know that if you look at the other major topic, which is always discussed these days, climate change, people say growth is bad. So is the system based on credit? Is it the right system going forward? Or would you say, well, you know, we have to really reinvent how we do economics?
Well, I structure the proposals along the lines of what would be the easiest to do institutionally to what would be the hardest thing to do institutionally. And this sort of goes back to the old kind of Hayekian insight, which is the institutions are actually there for a purpose. Don't think things just happened without a purpose. The evolutionary process ensures that if they're there, there's a reason for them. So if you buy into that, and lots of people don't, of course, you know, totally understand that. But if you buy into that, my conclusion is you'd start off by changing policy. The first and most obvious thing to do is you'd use monetary policy to lean against booms and busts. And we don't do that at the moment. You know, there's been a wholesale refusal to use monetary policy to lean against the boom. To sort of say there's fragilities building up here, I don't like it, I'll lean against it. That'd be item number one. You'd use regulatory policy and monetary policy to lean against the boom. The next thing is you'd change behavior. So it's people, it's the lenders, okay? Like you were making reference earlier on to the people like the pension funds, et cetera, who will suffer losses, okay? The creditors in the end, if the debtors can't pay, the creditors don't get paid. It's the lenders that lose money. Those lenders, in most instances, and I'm not talking so much about pension fund here, but banks in particular, think about pre-European crisis banking. Those guys should have known better. They made loans to bad debtors. They knew what they were getting into and they got away unscathed. When I talk about changing behavior, okay, you should change the laws, for example, to say that when people make egregiously bad loans in order to prop up their own asset prices, whatever, those people should go to jail. So that instead of fining banks, you know, taking out of the pockets of the shareholders, you should take it out of the lives of the people that did the bad lending. You can think of ways in which you could make the punishment fit the crime.
Yeah, or go give the risk back, which is taken away. Yeah.
And then you can change structure. We don't like globalization. We don't like securitization. We don't like consolidation. Well, you can think of ways of dealing with that, you know. So globalization, no more branches, just all separately capitalized subs. Securitization, it's not collateral that counts. It's your estimate of future earnings. Well, then you move beyond that. And of course, in the background, you always have the issue of why don't you just raise the capital levels, you know, which is Martin Helvig.
You mean more equity. Basically, you mean more equity.
Yeah, and that opens a whole range of things, right? You sort of look back 20 years and say, you know, we made a big mistake by letting banks become, traded on stock markets. They should be mutually held. A bank should have 12 partners, 12 men and women sitting around a table, basically saying, this is my money and your money. Are we prepared to lend it to Joe Bloggs? His company.
So basically, you say you're giving the risk back into the system. Yep. So we have, for decades now, we have taken away the risks. And when something turned wrong, the central banks have stepped in, the governments have stepped in, rescued the people who were speculating, and the signal was clear, go out, take on debt, and speculate.
Yeah. Well, this gets you back into the next sort of on my list, things like free banking and narrow banking. In free banking, you know, they basically say, get rid of all the safety nets. They're all gone. All the safety nets, all the regulations. It just induces bad behavior. Get rid of it all. And then what you will have is, one, people will know it's their money that they're going to have to try to conserve. But you'll have all the other banks looking at any one bank that behaves badly and saying, we're not going to lend to you, interbank market, whatever, because we think you're behaving badly and your bad behavior will eventually cause problems for us. So the system will be stable. The narrow banking thing, as you know, basically says, well, banks will only be able to invest in treasury bonds. So all of the risky stuff will all be done by mutual funds and people will know the risks that they're taking and they'll take them. That's the way it'll work. And in that world, again, you'd get rid of regulation and you'd get rid of safety nets because you wouldn't need them. It's the same as with free banking, but in free banking, getting rid of regulation and the safety net is a prerequisite to free banking. Whereas in narrow banking, getting rid of safety nets and regulation is a byproduct for very different reasons.
I spoke with Professor Richard Werner a few weeks back, and he's a big fan of having this regional banking system in Germany, where he said basically these small mutual banks, this is basically, you would also go this direction, not these big institutions, but rather have small banks with a more local or regional touch being in a better position to give better credits.
Let's put it this way. I think you can make an argument in both directions. You look at sort of small regional banks, and you sort of say, well, that avoids the problem of too big to fail and that range of territory. But as my colleague Claudio Borio and Charles Goodhart's another one made the point that if you've got a bunch of small guys all basically behaving the same, you can get to exactly the same place, that they individually all look healthy, but the system is actually quite unhealthy. Regional banks, yes and no. So I don't profess to be a real expert in this stuff, but it is clear that there's arguments that you can put for one or for the other. The one point I would make is that when you look at Germany in particular, it does seem almost a recipe for things going wrong, for having a lot of big banks that can't make any money because there's so much competition from so many small banks. Somehow, putting it all together needs more thought than has been put into it thus far.
Understood. Dr. White, I would say, the outlook of our conversation actually is not so beautiful. At the end of the road, I think it was more fun the past years than what's coming, because understanding your logic, you say basically we're at the end of postponing the problem.
I think the central bankers themselves, when you hear them talking about the need for fiscal support, basically, that's what they're saying.
But the need for fiscal support still goes down in the direction of we get growth rates up, we get inflation up, we might be able to go down the path of financial repression. It's still not acknowledging their losses and we have to distribute the losses.
I think the debt restructuring thing, particularly on the private side and particularly with respect to low-income sovereigns, debt restructuring is something that we need to think a lot more carefully about. WP1 again at the OECD, the Group of 30, the IMF, Carmen Reinhart now, who's at the World Bank as the chief economist, all of these people have written articles, books even, about shortcomings in our capacity to restructure debt. And I have given various presentations in which I've tried to document some of these shortcomings with respect to private non-financial debt, private financial debt, too big to fail, and worst of all, sovereign debt, where there's no agreement at all about at what point do you need a sovereign debt restructuring. Indeed, I mean, as you know from the European case, thinking about Greece in particular, there aren't even any rules that prevent lending money to people or countries that obviously have far too much debt already. There's no impediment from other people making the problem worse. So I do think that more reflection about debt restructuring and building it right into the system. You know, there's a lot of going forward, for example, a lot of people have made suggestions about what are effectively risk contingent bonds, you know, so that countries, sovereigns issue bonds, for example, that pay out interest if they grow at X percent, and if they grow at less than that, they pay out less than that. Mortgages in which the banks and the person taking out the mortgage share in the gains and the losses. There's a lot of stuff out there that could be thought about in a more serious way. And maybe this pandemic will be, as I say, and now that it's made us say you've come to the end of the line with the kind of stuff that we've been doing, maybe we'll start thinking more seriously about some of these ideas that are already out there.
Oh, we have to. I think we have to. Yeah. Dr. Bai, thank you very much for spending time with me today for this discussion. And we might, if you are willing, we continue the discussion another time in the future, which would be really great if you had time. It was a true pleasure on my side. I learned a lot.
It's been a pleasure.
I wish you, first of all the best. Good end of the year. And
I hope we can do it again.
Thank you very much.
Soweit mein Gespräch mit William White. Ich hoffe, Sie teilen meine Einschätzung, dass das Gespräch leider immer noch hochaktuell und relevant ist. Das Ganze war ja zur Einstimmung auf den kommenden Sonntag, wo ich mit dem Professor Kenneth Rogoff von der Harvard University über die Zukunft des Dollars als globaler Weltwährung diskutiere. Ich freue mich also auf ein Wiederhören am kommenden Sonntag. Bis dahin alles Gute. Ihr Daniel Stelter.